the local judge wasn't doing his job, that we'd made an issue of discriminatory upgrading, bossing status, the local had passed a ruling that the men would be upgraded on the job to bossing status on the basis of seniority, which seemed fair enough, but then it turned out that the ship bosses were not observing this this local ruling. Now, and then they claimed that they weren't bound by it because they were members of the foreman's local and not the longshoreman's local 13. Playing games, he said in the ship gang situation, they changed the manner in which ship gangs would be handed out just when we had a black guy eligible to get a ship gang. We felt this was discriminatory and games were being played, and we wanted Harry to do something about it. He was head of the Coast Committee, the national president. Certainly could use the Constitution and the contract as far as I'm concerned. We were concerned, the committee. And so he told the delegation up there, he says, look, he says, I'm not going to upset Local 13 on the race issue. Cold turkey. And I looked at Mark, looked at old man Derek, and he looked at me as if to say, are we hearing what we're really hearing, And
you deal with old ships.
I said, well, we are concerned about Local 13 being upset. I said, well, this is the question of doing it, what is right, according to the Constitution, and our own Constitution, and this contract language supports it. So you can join with the employers. I said, you don't have to do it. I said, it can be a joint thing. He said, well, I wouldn't join with the employers before Local 13 to do anything. And I knew that was a lie, because I had known him to do it. I knew him to do it before. I knew he'd do it again.
He was no real friend of Local 13, from what I was told. He had a lot of disagreements with the
I should say. But on this question, on race discrimination, I expected a whole lot more out of the guy. This is my first. This is the first time I really felt I really began to really know him. I had an awful lot of respect for that guy prior the real conversation. I had some doubts because, we tried to get him to do a few things, and I always excuse him some way. The guy probably thinking, he'll come down, But anyway.
What do you think? What do you think was behind all that as far as Harry Bridges was concerned? Politics?
He was unpopular enough at Local 13. He knew if he... did anything in support of what we were trying to accomplish there in terms of fair upgrading of black members, make an awful lot of people angry. Looking at, like I say, the membership at that time, in my opinion, was mostly reactionary. Now, I'm not saying everybody was that way or that they were basically like that. No, because I have. We made a lot of friends. The membership today is a lot closer. There's far less hard racist feeling today than there were in those times.
Yeah, I like to go back to the 40s, early 40s, during the war. You were seemed to be involved in a lot more than just union activities. You were involved in things going on in the community too, weren't you?
Yeah.
Could you describe some of that?
Well, mainly it was the fight for jobs and working with the Victory Committee, because employment has always been plagued, in the black community. And Russell was Reverend Russell Clayton, Dr. Clayton B. Russell. He was in my opinion, he was doing pretty much the only job, the only real job in the community in terms of getting, you know, work for unemployed black people on a large scale. And nobody could feel the need any, you know, for this any more than, and see the need for it any more than I did because of my own experience. Starting with truck driving and this, the experience in the foundry and then, you know, finding out what it was like in Longshore and what you really had to do. And I actually, we needed the committee in the worst kind, in the worst kind of way during those times, because even though jobs became more plentiful during World War II, you know, it just wasn't easy to walk in and get some of the better jobs. And so I really was working, you know, pretty much with the Victory Committee. And then after that, I guess I confined my activities to the struggle inside Longshore for upgrading of, you know, black longshoremen, because that was a bitter struggle. It even went right into, you're talking about 42.
Did it change your experiences with the longshore? Did it change your attitude towards the CIO any, and all the CIO meant to the black community?
Well, it made me, well, I couldn't remain naive after that. Yeah. About what the CIO was all about. I mean, people are going to be people, and they're going to have their prejudices, and they're going to feel however they're going to feel about other groups of people, you know, the racial identities and what have you. But I did not become really disillusioned with the CIO, because, I mean, I guess I sort of grew up. And I realized that, after all, I mean, people who became members of a trade union or a church didn't necessarily immediately lose their old prejudices and racist feelings. I felt that it would have, you know, membership in a union such as a CIO would have an influence on the way they felt, because it did teach, you know, unity and togetherness, and pointed out the necessity for people to be together regardless of, you know, racial identity, for the sake of preserving their jobs, you know, for the sake of job security. And so I know it wasn't a modern thing, and I know that I came to realize the CIO certainly wasn't panacea, you know, for the problems that we faced. You know.
Did they get involved in things like the fight against racial restrictive covenants and housing, for instance, in the community?
Are you talking about in 42?
Anytime in the 40s, yeah.
The CIO, as I knew it, was always supportive of those things.
Direct involvement?
Of better housing. Now, I can't say, I'm not able to say that, but I mean as a policy, in terms of statements being issued to the newspaper. I think the Industrial Council went on record in support of better housing for minorities and public housing projects. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were supporting all of this.
But was there any movement in the CIO among the black trade unionists to try to form any type of a coalition as trade unionists to take some action on these things?
I honestly can't recall.
How about the one thing I read about in the California Eagle was child care that the CIO was providing during the war. Do you remember anything about that?
I vaguely do remember some sort of program that was, I don't know whether the CIO initiated the program, but I think they were involved in the top care program.
You don't remember very much about that?
No, I don't. They kept me too busy.
Yeah, I guess trying to break down the barriers in a shop where there's enough to keep anybody.
Yeah, trying to get those names on membership cards.
Yeah.
But I can say this, that I think, you know, recalling my experiences in the CIO, that Philip Connolly, as the leader, was a very brilliant and confident man as secretary, executive secretary of the Industrial Labor Council. He was really concerned with organization.
Yeah.
Get out and organize those people in the shops.
Feel the same way about you?
Sorry?
Feel the same way about me?
Who
I spoke to?
Oh, you spoke to him? It's a whole new world. Had it not been for the CIO, I would have been very much anti-labor. As you can understand, my experiences were with the, you know, with the AFL unions were very bitter, very bad. And I feel the CIO really did open the way for many, many, many jobs. There's countless jobs, good jobs for black people that made it possible for them to live a better life and educate their children. As you can understand, was for the AFL that prevailed. I mean, our plight would be a very, I'm much sorrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. How about women in the Boilermakers or the ILWU in that period? There were a lot of black women going into
aircraft. Well, yeah, in the Boilermakers Union there were plenty because women were welders and I guess they were burners and riveters. And, well, I don't know about that. It was pretty heavy riveting there. But they were doing pretty much the same things that men were doing during World War II in the shipyard.
Mm-hmm.
In the shipyard. And
how did they take care of their children when they were at the job?
Well, I'm sure some of them used daycare centers and babysitters. Any way they could, you know, they'd make arrangements for them. Sure, they took advantage of their own daycare nursery situation.
Did they raise that as an issue within the union, do you remember?
Not in the Boilermakers Union, because I had no opportunity, you know, to really observe what was going on, because if it took place, it took place in regular memberships in the Boilermakers Union. So I was not allowed to attend, you know.
Right.
But the auxiliary didn't take place there. The issue wasn't presented there because we would not attend the auxiliary meetings. We boycotted the auxiliary, and there's very few things that were done there. The meetings were very poorly attended, as I can recall, to begin with, and then when we put the screws on, in fact, it was 95%, you know, effective.
How about in Longshore? Were there also women there? And
no, well, women are new to the Longshore industry. They're there now, but in very, very limited, very limited numbers. I think last year, I think, the first one that came to work. And I think it was this year. Wait a minute, no. It was about April. I think the first black woman came to work. Was it this year or the latter part of last year? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
There's only one. But I think there's still like only about five. There's about five non-black women and one black woman working there now. Who was part of the committee, he was a member of our shipyard workers committee, a fellow by the name of Earl Gray. And Earl says that you know, he just enjoys every day. He says, walking to the line, he said, I enjoy every day thinking that I was part of the struggle, you know, to integrate bias into the moral nature of unity. But because, he says, I have friends now that are working there, and they know that they wouldn't have been there and had these permanent jobs had it not been for the struggle. And I don't know how many. I think maybe at one point I should make it a point to just really do a survey and find out just how many blacks are working in the barn as a group.
How do you think Taft Hartley and that whole period affected the attitude of the union towards black members?
Well, I don't think it made them feel any better. It made them want to accept blacks any more readily. In fact, I think it would be probably harder to feel for them. I really feel that this is the case more than anything else.
And in Longshore, this sponsorship program where a person would be able to hand their book down to their son or nephew or whatever, that eventually, after the blacks were re-registered, the 500 were re-registered, you eventually got to the point where you could also have those privileges. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, that is correct. But
something
that
happened
policy,
to that,
that policy. It does not exist.
Right. How did it happen just about the time? There was a court ruling that overturned it. Did that happen about the time?
it came to the point where blacks had survived the seniority policy, which I'm saying that you would get a chance to sponsor on the basis of your seniority in the industry. Which meant there were an awful lot of non-blacks who sponsored before. I guess it covered a span of maybe 20 years or so before we got a chance to sponsor.
You were the victims of that.
Victims of the seniority system, I understand. Because prior to that, I don't think the seniority system prevailed. I think it was, come whoever. But all of a sudden they passed this ruling of the sponsorship system and the replacement seniority that said automatically shut this way down. Mm-hmm. And we survived it, and it was a really bitter thing to think about it when it came time to for us to sponsor. They were talking about, there was talk about changing the sponsorship system and all that sort of thing. And I can remember in 1953 that I think the largest number of the largest groups of blacks had filed sponsorship notices or papers. I think there must have been somewhere between 35 and 45, and which is, you know, just unprecedented. Well, really unprecedented too. Because we had not been able to bring anybody into the industry. And I was very vigilant at the time, and so were the Henderson boys and some of the old guys that had been very active with me in trying to get blacks upgraded. And we noticed bulletins being, the language being changed a little bit, you know, on the various bulletins that the PMA would place in the pay office. Saying that, well, it was to the effect that this current registration of class, new Class B members would probably, might possibly be canceled, you know. And, so naturally we became very concerned, because we couldn't expect anything good to come of it, you know. So then, as we continued to check from one week to the next, and we found that very definitely that there were very live plans to cancel it out. And so, I think it was three of us, we went over to see the manager on this question. And we told him that if they canceled the registration, it meant automatically that if they were going to open up again, then on a seniority basis, that there were going to be fewer blacks to sponsor, because we found out that the reason that the union was giving for canceling that was that they didn't give some of the old timers enough notice for them to come in and use the sponsorship, and that would be bad for the old timers. Some of them might not survive until the next sponsorship, blah blah blah, you know. So we told the area manager that if they did cancel it, we were going to not only file a complaint locally, but we were going to file a legal complaint against PMA and the union, because of the result of it would be discriminatory. The effect of it would be discriminatory. So McAvoy, he's still in the manager. He asked me if we could prove this. I said, yeah, we can prove it. We did research to find out how many blacks are eligible to sponsor. And he said there were, about 30, somewhere between 35, maybe 45, that would might possibly be canceled out. If they had that many old-timers, that number of blacks would not sponsor. So he said that if that would be the effect of it, that PMA wouldn't be a party to it. I said, well, you can check the record yourself. I challenged him, check the record. And he said, well, I don't know whether you'd be able to tell who's why, but I know better. We knew better. I said, well, I'm sure you, I said, if you have any problem, I said, we can tell you. Because, see, when we searched the records, they had, we had ways to tell. The code was there.
Yeah.
See. And so PMA took a stand at that time. That they were not going to cancel. And there was a joint LRC meeting held here locally on this question in Wilmington. And I happened to be around at the time when they were discussing it, and they called me in because it was, I had signed the complaint, I had drafted it and signed it along with I think two of the other guys. And I remember PMA saying that after I read the complaint, that they concurred with the complaint, and that they were going to refuse to concur with the recommendation of the union to cancel the current registration.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as a result, the union representatives, some of them became very PO'd, and they first said, well, we're not going to take these people in as members, and they'll never become members of the union, blah, blah, blah. And I remember PMA's position, well, that's your business. The union business is your business, but they will work out of that hiring hall. Okay? And they will benefit otherwise. They have the same benefits as the regular members. So, ultimately, they did go through the registration. And the union did collect the union dues. And that's what happened in that situation. I was in 56.
Okay. Scott?